going to agree with you, Joe. As you go down in frequency, the same amount of spacing is a smaller number of wavelengths. Therefore, the wavelength of spacing is going down as you go down in frequency in general. However, that is not a showstopper. If the two antennas on a lower frequency move close together, both get capacitive loading to each other, and they both get lowered in resonant frequency. You're able to re-resonate them at a higher frequency. And there's about three different ways you can do that. You can move them up in frequency by shortening the length of the radiator. But maybe you don't want to cut the radiator because you want to leave it pristine. You can now put that G-connector at the bottom of the antenna and put the right size shunt inductor to bring it back up in frequency. So there's various ways that you can electronically tune the antenna right at the feed point to go make it go up or down in frequency, as well as up and down in impedance and so on, and get rid of the reactants. There's all kinds of sexy ways that you can readjust the antenna for that particular environment without necessarily permanently damaging that antenna. Do you see what I'm saying on that one, Joe? To be 2LYY, T2LIW in the TechNet. Good question.
Yes, I do. Let me just let the second reset here. Yeah, what I noticed with using the antenna return loss bridge, it basically, if I removed, say I was working on a 10-meter antenna and put the 6-meter antenna on another mount on the roof, even as it being fairly far away, what you'd watch is the return loss, the bottom of it, become not quite as sharp. You lost the sharpness of your dip. If it was dipped at one particular frequency and looking, maybe it had a return loss of minus 20, minus 22 or something like that, you would see, you'd lose that dip and it would seem to flatten it out a little bit without readjusting the length of that antenna. That's what I pretty much noticed by playing with the antenna. And if I purposely put it closer to each other, it would broaden out the entire pattern, return loss pattern, and make it a little higher, like approaching minus 10 or minus 12. Back to you.
Yeah, you're doing the right thing when you look at return loss. Whether you're doing it with a network analyzer, it's a sophisticated way, or whether you're doing it with a bird watt meter, a directional through line watt meter, for instance, or any other kind of VisWatt measuring device. When you're looking at reflected power, it has this peculiar characteristic. If you've got an impedance match that is so good, at least at the center frequency, so that the return loss goes down to, let's say, minus 30 dB, that minus 30 dB dip, in definition, is going to be very sharp. If you now, and that's where the antenna hit exactly 50 ohms with no reactants at that center frequency. If the antenna hit 55 ohms at no reactants at the center frequency, then you're going to get a dip, instead of 30 dB down, it's going to be 18 dB down. By definition, an 18 dB dip is going to be a lot more broader than the 30 dB dip, even though the real bandwidth of the antenna might be almost the same. Whenever you get a very deep dip, by definition, it almost always becomes a very sharp dip. That would lead you to believe you're getting an extremely high Q antenna with very sharp tuning, because you get this very narrow, very sharp dip. It's easy to fall into that trap, Joe, and a dip that's not as deep looks like it's nowhere near as sharp. But if you now went back, let me drop this. If the best dip you could get on your antenna that's not matched so well, that's only a 15 dB dip, and you looked at the 12 dB points on that antenna, what frequency upper and lower hits the 12 dB dip instead of the center 15 dB dip, and now you take the very sharp dip antenna that hits minus 30, but you again look for the frequency of the 12 dB reflection on the low side and the 12 dB reflection, right, you're going to find out the separation in frequency for 12 dB in those two cases is going to be almost the same. The two antennas have really almost the same bandwidth, even though one has a very good dip because it truly hits 50.0 ohms, and the other one doesn't have so deep a dip because it only hits 55 ohms, if you know what I mean. You can easily be fooled by that one, Joe. And I know that John has also had a little bit of trouble with this one. When you're using the network analyzer, and you're looking at the bumpiness of the swept frequency curve of reflection, it's very easy to get the misimpression. The good news about looking at reflection, it's very sensitive to making a good impedance match. Let me drop the reflection information gives you a very fine-tuned way of seeing what's going on. but you got to be careful how you interpret it. I mean, an extremely good antenna across its bandwidth would have minus 20 dB reflection coefficient or better, okay? If the antenna went down to minus 20 from the low end of the band to the high end of the band, you and I would jump up and down with joy. Better than minus 20 dB would be minus 25 or minus 30, okay? If the antenna at the low end was minus 20, and a couple of places in the middle of the band it hit minus 30, and at the high end of the band it hit minus 20, is that a worse antenna? Hell no. It's a better antenna. It's better than minus 20 dB on certain portions of the band. But when you see that plot, you see all kinds of wiggles and dips to it, and you're led to believe this is a very poorly tuned antenna. You've got to be careful how you interpret reflection coefficient. So, minus 20 or better is a really good antenna, and the fact that somewhere in there it hits minus 50, and it's a sharp-looking curve, and it's a wiggly-looking curve, but every bit of it is minus 20, that's a damn good antenna. The fact that it's got those spikes that go further down, those are the best areas, if you know what I mean, even though it's a very bumpy-looking curve. So you got to be careful how you judge the way you use a vector network analyzer. A powerful tool, but it can be misinterpreted at first. W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Well, I was trying to bring this question up on the net because you never know what kind of answer you're going to get.
Yeah, I guarantee on that one you get a slightly different answer than expected. It was slightly different than I expected. Now, we did have an interruption. Maybe his battery ran down or whatever. Greg, we're going to give you another chance. N2AIR. Hope you've come back to us. N2AIR in Maspeth. K2IW in the TechNet. Go right ahead, Greg.
Dick, when you get a chance, I'd like to give it another try. And so we'll pick up the other station.
N2AIR, are you there, Greg? K2LIW?
Dick, I hope so. Quick question. Short version of the question. Is there a way to increase capacitive inductance on a mag-mounted ham stick for 20 through 10 meters? And does it really make a difference? N2AIR.
Okay, you've got a hamstick antenna, and I think you said it's a mag mount, and there's a certain amount of capacitance between your magnet and thin sheet of plastic and the rest of the sheet metal of your car. And if it's a well-made, well-designed antenna, the antenna was designed to operate at your favorite frequency with that amount of capacitance present. Therefore, if you're using the antenna the way the manufacturer recommended using it, and if you're using it on the frequency where he designed it, there should be no problem. Now, if for some reason you think that that amount of capacitance should be increased, I'm not quite sure why you would want to do that. In other words, the fact that that capacitor is there, maybe you're modifying somebody else's antenna, and that capacitance is giving you a little bit higher frequency of resonance than you want, there's ways you can retune the antenna to live with the amount of capacitance you've got. You can also increase that capacitance by halving the thickness of that sheet of plastic. I don't recommend you go too far on that one because you might, let me drop the DPZ with any comments. You might go, as you start making the sheet of plastic too thin, you got to start worrying about the fact that the magnet may wear through your plastic and start grinding onto the paint of your car. And although you and I would tolerate that, the wife will say that, gee, you're scratching up my beautiful car with your silly mag mount. So you got to be careful on that one. So, yes, you can make the capacitor get bigger by making the spacing of that plastic of the mag mount a smaller number. Or you could go the next step. M squared sells you a triple mag mount, a structure that will hang on to any car. You can put a huge whip on that. And so when that triple mag mount is on your car, boy, it's going to have four or five times the amount of capacitance of a simple single capacitor type mag mount. So there's ways to retune the antenna, there's ways of making more capacitance. And so what modification are you doing to an antenna, Greg, that makes you think you need this? N2AIR, K2LIW in the TechNet. DPZ with a comment. Greg, you got it. Stand by, Hal.
Okay, real quick, I was just wondering if it's even worth the difference, you know, in straps, like 3/4 to 1 inch ground straps, and laying them out radially connected to the ground side of the antenna, and just laying them on the roof of the car. That's one thing I was thinking. Like I said, I don't even know if I need it. Depending on propagation, I do just fine running QRP from the beachfronts, like at Cap Tree and Robert Moses State Park, Sunken Meadow, etc., and to AIR.
Now back up, Greg. You sound like you think you need more capacitance of your mag mount. What led you to believe that you think you need more capacitance, Greg? Go ahead.
I was just wondering if it's worth going through the effort. I mean, on days when propagation is fairly good, just running straight ham sticks, 20 through 10 meters, I do quite well with 5 watts, and some days I don't. It's just the vagaries of propagation. I was wondering if I can make it just a hair better, or if it's not even worth the effort.
Okay, I think I see where you're going here, and that is, depending on what the state of the ionosphere is, some days a wet noodle as an antenna is more than enough, and other days the best high-gain Yagi is not going to cut it if the band is closed, so to speak, on 10 meters. So that ionosphere, when the band is open versus the band being closed, believe it or not, that ionosphere being there doing its thing can easily make 90 decibels of difference in signal strength between you and that guy you want to talk to. Now, on the days when the ionosphere is marginal, just barely there, you wish you had a little more performance out of the antenna, you're suspicious that your antenna's capacitive coupling is losing you some of that performance. I don't blame you for thinking that. I'm going to give you a test that allow you to find out whether or not it's true. Let me drop. If that capacitive coupling to your mag mount, to the rest of your vehicle, for instance, is giving you grief, the only way it can give you grief is that it's detuning the antenna in some way. It wasn't part of the design. You've changed the size of the magnet. You've changed the size of the plastic sheet thickness so that the amount of capacitance it was tuned to changed along those lines. If you measure the standing wave ratio of that antenna under working conditions, and if you get anything better than 1.5 to 1 or 2 to 1 in that order, you know you've got 95% of the energy going down that transmission line being radiated by that antenna into space. In the case of this mag mount on a car on a upper HF frequency, for instance, I'll admit on 80 meters other things start happening, but on the upper HF frequencies, as long as the standing wave ratio is low enough, you're getting a good impedance match, and if you wanted to do the next step of proving it, you look at that antenna with a thermal imaging camera. The only way the antenna can lose energy is to turn it into heat. Let me drop. You've got two very good ways of confirming whether or not it's being turned into heat. If you are very well equipped, as I said, you look at it with a thermal imaging camera when you're putting 100 watts into the antenna. The more simple approach that we all can do is you put 100 watts into that antenna, for instance, and maybe 10 watts would be enough, but you do it for 5 or 10 minutes. Turn off the RF energy, go over there and touch everything. If everything on that antenna is ice cold to your hand, and you've been putting a 50 or 100 watts into it for the last 5 minutes, that antenna, by definition, is running at 97 or better percent efficiency. All that energy, if it's not coming back to you by way of standing wave ratio, that means your bird watt meter says all the power is flowing forward and very little of it is flowing back. That means you're getting a good impedance match. And now if under working conditions it runs ice cold, it is radiating that power. You may be losing some sweet thinking that capacitor on the mag mount is losing you some power. I doubt it. Very difficult for it to do that. And if it did it, it would get hot to the touch. There is no other mechanism by which it can eat up your valuable RF power than to turn it into heat. I think you see where I'm going on this one now. So by divide and conquer, you can do these kinds of tests and confirm that your antenna is already giving you the performance you want as far as radiation efficiency is concerned. Let me drop. The only thing beyond that where you can buy more performance is to make the antenna bigger. big enough that it's got an elevation pattern that's lower to the horizon, and now by way of a better gain pattern, you can pick up some more performance. But when it comes to losing energy because of your mag mount, I highly doubt it. You've used good common sense to think that's happening, but I think it's very unlikely, Greg. And I'd like to believe you're worrying unnecessarily. You're losing some sleep over this one, and you shouldn't be. N2 AIR, and you can do those tests and tell us what you find out. K2RIW, you got it, Greg.
Okay. Hey, you actually told me what I was hoping you would tell me. Thanks a lot, Dick. So I'm not going to lose any more sleep about it. I'm not going to think about it anymore. Like I say, some days you feel like a nut, some days on HF. So I'm just going to take it as it comes. I'm a very casual operator. I go out there to enjoy the sunrise, and if I don't make any contacts, I usually go fishing. So that's the way I view it. But thanks for the input, and yeah, not worth any extra effort. N2AIR, have a good evening.
N2AIR, Dick, I'd like to give it another shot.
Make a comment before AIR goes and give him a suggestion. Yeah, by way of the test equipment you already own, by way of your friends, you can get a hold of a standing wave ratio meter or a bird watt meter. You can find out how much power is going forward and how much power is coming back. And by way of the extended power into the antenna for a length of time, and finding out if anything gets hot, you can find out if it's losing any power. So you have the means of confirming that it's got near 100% efficiency right now, Greg. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
Okay, what I'm going to say is very simple. If you put a 19-inch NMO mount on the top of your car, what you can do is take and make very small, top-loaded little coils and work 80 through 10 meters with a 19-inch spike. I've done it, and I've worked all over the world running very low power, and with a 19-inch spike antenna on an NMO mount, you can wind your own little coils, put them right on top of the NMO mount, push them down on top. I used I forgot the size of the diameter of the spike antenna, the rod, fits into a very small pitch jack. I made all my own coils out of pill bottles, and I had 80 through 10 meters, and it worked fantastically. Don't play with magnetic mounts and all this crap. You can't get the efficiency, because the lower the frequency, you just cannot get the ground plane effect. That's my comment. K6DPZ.
Okay, on the TechNet, from time to time, you will hear differences of opinion, and this is one of those times. There's no clearly defined situation as to who's right and who's wrong. So you're going to hear both sides of the equation, so to speak, and you make the judgment. Hal, what's confusing me is that Greg specifically said he must use a mag mount. He doesn't want to cut holes in the sheet metal of the car. Your NMO mount technique that you're describing, he would have to drill holes in the car. He doesn't want to do that. So I'm very confused as to why you made that suggestion with his original description of what he's doing. And second of all, you have an opinion that any capacitive mounting between the mag mount and the rest of the car is a lossy structure. That's a well-felt opinion by a lot of people, but it hasn't been confirmed, in my opinion, by laboratory measurement. In order to get loss that you're describing, you'd have to get hot. That mag mount doesn't get hot. The mag mount is another series capacitor. You and I have the ability to retune the antenna in the presence of that capacitor and give it full resonant performance. So I'm not quite sure why you've taken this approach, Hal. K6DPZ for a rebuttal. K2RIW the TechNet. Believe it or not, this is friendly.
IW the TechNet, K6DPZ. Now, I got a little late on the conversation, but he was mentioning he was working QRP. He didn't want to have any major thing. And putting a simple NMO mount in the center of the car, in the back, gives him a 2-meter antenna, plus it gives him an HF antenna. I did this, I took pill boxes, little pill jars, and I made up little coils that just went right on top of the NMO 19-inch spike. And by doing that, I had these little coil boxes, I wound the coils, and I had an all-band mobile antenna, 2 meters through 80, and it was phenomenal how well it worked. suggestion, but then what do I know? I'm just a bit ahead for 57 years. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, you guys have just heard two fairly different approaches to solving this problem. And you'll be the judge as to which one you want to take. Okay, yeah. Rich, when I go back to you, go directly to the question you're asking. And to EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, Professor, make a comment after if it's okay. Question, I'm going to Maritron sooner coming back to me. Barry and Slim, he has it. It was struck by lightning, the 1 meter module board is a crispy critter. There's probably some other stuff. None of these work. Maybe it's scratched. I don't know. But anybody had any experience sending things back to a Maritron? Not for repair, but for refurbishing. Back to net.
Okay, so Rich is asking, in the case of an antenna tuner, for instance, made by a Maritron, does anyone on frequency have experience with a Maritron doing repair? Were you satisfied or unsatisfied with the repair? If you've got a comment on that question, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. We may not have anybody on frequency that has that experience, Rich, and good luck with that. Okay, we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in with a question. And we're a little bit slightly behind schedule, but my schedule is not that rigid. We go with the flow, if you know what I mean. There are times when guys are so excited with the questions they were asking that we go on for 2 hours instead of 1 hour for the question and answer section in the beginning. The world doesn't end because we do that, even though there are people out there saying, you didn't stick with the schedule.
Dick, did you want to take Wesley's question? I think he said he had a question. I'm not sure.
No, Wesley has got a deeper subject he wants to discuss. You can tell by way of the email. And that's the way he words it to us. It's time to go to the mailbag now, John. K6DPZ, here we go. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I hope these guys with the mailbag tonight are not going to snow us again. That last one we got, a darn good question about the weight of electrons. We haven't settled that one yet. You got it, John, K2RIW. But we're working on it.
Yeah, the weight of electrons. Well, I don't have any electrons to weigh anyway, so we can skip that. Yeah, good question. All right, have a young gentleman who acquired an instrument at a flea market, and it's a square law meter. He'd like to know what he has and what it's used for and what information does it gather and what does that whole term mean. So maybe you can give him a little lecture on the use of a square law meter. It's an HP. I don't know the model number, but I'm sure you've seen them, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
Now, I wonder if the meter itself says that the display it gets, and maybe this is a Darcy's bell movement, does it truly say that it's always displaying the square of the voltage? Or is it saying that it is a true RMS meter which works by doing an internal squaring function, and maybe he's reading the instruction manual and the method of operation. So do you believe the meter says true RMS measurement, or does it really say square law measurement? Because if it truly says everything it displays is the square of the voltage, not the voltage directly, I've seen a lot of Hewlett-Packard instruments in my 40 years of experience. I haven't seen that one. I can make some speculations as to what I think it's doing, but I'm wondering if that's what it really says. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, if I remember the HP instrument, it does say square law. So he doesn't have an instruction book, but he's trying to obtain that. He has no idea of what the term means. He's been trying to research it on Google, and he's found it very confusing. So maybe you give him a quick synopsis, and then if he has further questions, next week we can pick it up again if he sends me another email. But just give him the best rundown you can. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
DP's out of the comment. There's at least two places where the square law display would be valuable. One is a crystal diode detector, looking at threshold signals up to the level of from minus infinity up to minus 20 dBm. That is a very square law responding device, a crystal detector with forward bias, looking for threshold weak signals, like for instance a radar detector. That's one kind of square law performance that would be very valuable. Another was the fact that whenever you're trying to display the power of a signal, power is E squared over R, so the square of the voltage is proportional to the power being displayed on that line. So a meter that gives you OE square law performance would tell you what is the power ratio between signal A and signal B, so to speak. That's a second performance. There's also a kind of operational amplifier characteristic where square law is very valuable. Let's see what Hal's going to say on all of the above. I wonder if you've seen a Hewlett-Packard meter that says it is a square law meter. And if so, how do you believe most measurement shops would use a thing like that? K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
IW TechNet, K6DPZ. If you can give me the HP model number, I have a whole HP library, and I can pull a manual or a spec and give them anything he needs, if he just sends me an SAS, how's that?
That's an attractive offer, Hal. And from the way John just gave us the question, I'm reasonably sure he does not know the HP model number. Let's make sure that's
correct, Dick. I do not know. He didn't give me that information.
That would be on the instrument. If it's a complete instrument, you know, it'd be there. And that's all I need. I'll pull the specifications and the operating part of the manual. He just has to send me an SASE and I'll do it for him.
And as I said, that's an attractive offer. And so maybe John will get the exact model number. But a square law, a crystal diode detector with forward bias looking for very weak signals. If you've got a crystal diode front-end receiver, or maybe you've got some RF amplification, and downrange you've got a crystal diode detector. The laws of physics dictate that a crystal detector being used for a weak signal detection, as I said, from very weak signals up to a level of roughly minus 20 dBm, a crystal detector does respond in a square law manner. And so a meter that's connected to that crystal detector, that's also square law. It sounds like we've got square law cascaded with square law. That may not be the right way to go. I'm going to make another guess. As I said, because power on any system is E squared over R. If it's a 50-ohm coaxial cable, for instance, and if I go from 1 volt on that and I go to 2 volts, and I square 1 volt and I get 1, I square 2 volts and I get 4, 2 volts on a coaxial cable is 4 times as much power as 1 volt. So therefore, a meter that always displays the square of the voltage it's measuring would be showing you the power relationship. And you first look at signal A and take a reading, and signal B and take a reading, and you know how much more power is being represented from one reading to the other by way of the square law. There's also some funny things that happen when second harmonics are present. If you take the square law of a second harmonic, you can do some fancy mathematics with it. And so the next thing I would be concerned about is what is the frequency response. Most meters that are made for looking at sine wave-like signals, let me drop this. Most meters that look at sine wave-like signals have an upper frequency response and quite often a lower frequency response. Your particular digital voltmeter that you own, if you read its manual, you may find out that on the AC scale, it goes down to 10 hertz and up to 10 kilohertz, or maybe 1 kilohertz. And so if the sine wave you're measuring is lower in frequency than 10 hertz, in my example, because the way it operates in the AC scale, there's a coupling capacitor in there, so it doesn't respond to the DC component. So below 10 hertz, in my example, is going to start falling off in performance. And there's ways you can recalibrate for that. And in many cases, particularly a true RMS AC voltmeter, it has almost always an upper frequency response, which might be 1 KC or 10 KC, where if you put in an AC signal of a higher frequency, then it may not give you the proper performance according to the manufacturer. So I guess we need a little more information on this one, John. When I pass it back to you, John, drag your feet in case somebody listening to us knows about this Hewlett-Packard so-called square law meter. They may have seen one of those. They may have actually used it in their place of business. And if so, we'd like them to chime in right now and tell us what they know. KC2WGB with a delay for anyone that wants to join us on this subject. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I'm going to email him for the model number, and then we can get either myself, I may have a diagram for it, or the instruction book, but I'm not sure why, but Hal will probably have it. So I'll get more information, and then we can chase that down. So let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next question. Okay, this one's coming from a young amateur who just got a bird watt meter, and he has the slug, which is proper. And he's using it on 2 meters, and the slug he has will handle 100 watts. Now his question is it all right to rotate that slug for the reverse reading or the forward reading while the power is applied to the instrument, or does he have to turn the power off? A good question. Maybe give him a quick idea, a quick instruction about how they work, and evidently he believes that that power is traveling through the slug itself. So back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I've got in my hand August issue of QST Magazine, where in the Doctor is In section on page 57, there is some information on this situation. Okay, I've owned bird watt meters for lots of years. I've seen slugs that have been damaged, and almost always the slug gets damaged for physical reasons. Somebody drops it on the floor, beats it up in some way. And so if the slug is rated for the power level at which you're running, there is, to my knowledge, absolutely nothing wrong with flipping that slug from forward to reverse while the power is present. Let me show you why. What you just heard was Eric, KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer, who has used bird watt meters at tens of kilowatt levels in his broadcast experience, flipping the slug all the time. The way the bird watt meter works, if you look at it, if you remove the slug and look at the inside mechanism, you'll see a very precisely made 50-ohm airtight coaxial cable that goes from the left side to the right side. I think it's something like a 3/8-inch diameter center rod with something like a 7/8-inch diameter outer conductor, and the ratios between those two is exactly a 50-ohm line. So whether you're running 1 watt or 10 kilowatts, that power is flowing down that center rod, and 99% of the power most of the time is flowing straight through the meter. The slug that you now add to that open hole that I just described has a little bit of a probe inside, a half turn hairpin, so to speak, that depending on whether it's a 1 watt slug or a 1 kilowatt slug, determines how close is that hairpin when the slug is installed, how close is the hairpin to that center line. That hairpin samples a very small fraction most of the time of the power that's flowing down that center conductor. That power in turn that's picked up by that little hairpin slug, little hairpin inside the slug, inside that white section that you usually can't see inside of. Let me drop it. That little hairpin picks up a few milliwatts of the power that's flowing down. Whether it's a 1 watt slug or a 10 kilowatt slug, it readjusts its distance because you've chosen the right size of slug, so to speak, that always picks up the same amount of power, roughly a few milliwatts of what's flowing down. That few milliwatts goes into a diode rectifier, goes into a frequency selective circuit, and then it gets displayed on the Dawson-Bell movement. So that when you flip from the forward mode to the reverse mode, all you're doing is slowly rotating that hairpin. And as you rotate it, in one direction, it picks up only the forward power. And when you rotate it 180 degrees, it picks up only the reverse power. And as you continue turning it for the first time, far to the left and far to the right, the the little slug inside and its rectifying diode network makes contact with those circumferential contacts that go around that slug on the meter face itself, and it makes contact, and now the meter movement moves. And so when you're in the intermediate rotating positions, the slug is still picking up the same power, it's still being rectified, it's just not being connected to the meter. So the fact that the meter suddenly jumps to the reading when you get all the way clockwise or all the way counterclockwise would lead you to believe you're turning it on and turning it off, so to speak. Don't worry. So lots and lots of people, in fact, of all the people who work in radio, let me drop this. Of all the people who work in radio for lots and lots of years who have used Bird through-line watt meter, I would say 99% of them have rotated that slug while the power is present. They all do it. Now, Eric, being in the broadcast industry for a whole lot of years, he's going to give us a few words on this, put a little more audio, and I'll bet you've never burned out a slug because you've done that, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Now, the amount of power that's actually going to the meter is a 0 to 1 milliamp meter. Ain't much going to it. Yeah, there's no problem rotating it back and forth. Although, when you're at the kilowatt mode, you still have a pretty comfortable feeling because, you know that the RF is flowing through that little piece of coax there, or that middle coax, actually. And, there's no problem. It's fully isolated from you. So, I've seen plugs go bad, not electrically, but, I mean, like, the end result is electrical, but people drop, they actually bend up the contacts in the meter, the meter movements get off the jewel, stuff like that, but, I've actually never seen a slug open up. K2RIW, K2J.
A6DPZ with a comment. Go ahead, Hal. I bet you rotated that slug while the transmitter was running. You got it, Hal.
First off, the meter movement in the Bird 43 is 30 microamps, not a milliamp. And if you rotate the slug while you're transmitting, it's not going to hurt the slug. Now, when you transport the Bird watt meter, you should have the slug pointer facing vertical. The reason being it's a sensitive movement. When the slug is placing vertical, you're shorting out the meter, so the meter is dampened, and the meter won't get damaged. Here's my little comment. It's K6DPZ.
That's good information. I'd like to believe that suggestion for transporting and putting it in the vertical position to dampen the meter, I'd like to believe that's in the owner's manual. And if the slug would become damaged because you're rotating it while the transmitter is on, if that was a damaging process, I'm awfully sure that Bird would have said so in the owner's manual. Guarantee you and I have read the owner's manual. We've never seen that. I don't remember seeing this very valuable section saying that when you rotate the slug vertical, it dampens the meter. I can see why, and that's a beautiful technique. How did you find that one out, Hal? As I read the manual, maybe I skipped that section by mistake. K6DPZ, K2RIW, good info.
Okay, the way I found it out, very simple. See, the meter movement goes right to the contact in the line section. And many times, you'll find a Bird watt meter, someone will think it's bad. What happens, where the screw connection goes from the watt meter wire to the line section, oxidation builds up on that little contact, so it becomes open. So what happens, effectively, you think you have a blown watt meter, a blown meter in the watt meter. So it's a good habit, when you see a watt meter in a ham fest, if it has a slug, turn it halfway, rock the meter back and forth. If the meter movement is real free, it's either that little connection to the line section is got some oxidation, or the movement itself is open. That's my comment.
Yeah, darn good information. I'm glad to hear that one, Hal. One other warning I want to give you guys. There is a way that you doing something fairly logical can damage a slug. And let me show you how guys get into this trap. Let's assume that I'm a guy doing moon bounce. and I've got a kilowatt or 1500 watt output transmitter, and I want all that power to get to the antenna. I've done a very careful tuning job to make sure the antenna has got an extremely low standing wave ratio. I'd like the antenna to have 1000 watts going forward, and because it's such an extremely good, well-matched antenna, I've tuned the daylights out of it, I only have a watt coming back. And I want to measure that watt coming back. Under normal circumstances, I would choose the 1000 or 1500 watt slug to measure forward power, and I flip the slug into the reverse mode, and to now resolve the fact that only 1 watt is coming back, the needle is way down at the bottom of the scale, and you can't see it. It would be very tempting to reach into your box of slugs and pick up the 1 watt slug and plug in the 1 watt slug in the reverse mode. Do not do that. The fact that a forward power of 1500 watts is present, and you know darn well that if you put the slug in the forward mode, it's a 1 watt slug, and you're putting 1500 watts through it, you're going to damage it. By the same token, even though you know coming back down from the antenna is only 1 watt, and now you use the slug, a 1 watt slug, only in the reverse mode, while the 1500 watts is flowing forward, because of the way the slug develops its directivity, there is a terminating resistor built into that slug that must take the pickup power of that 1500 watts in the wrong direction, if you know what I mean. You will burn up that resistor in the slug. So, with rare exception, if you're using 1500 watt...
Repeater, timeout.
If your transmitter has the capability of 1500 watts, do not use a slug of lower power rating while testing that transmitter, no matter what you think the reverse power is. Because that forward power is present, the slug is picking up the power in both directions. It terminates the power of the wrong direction into its internal terminating resistor inside of that slug. A 1 watt slug cannot take 1500 watts into that resistor, the equivalent of that, what it picks up, if you know what I mean. So that's the one way people definitely have burned out slugs. I wonder if you're, you probably don't work with as many moonbound people as I do, Hal. You might not have run into this one. And maybe I can also ask Eric on that one. I'll bet you Eric, with his very carefully tuned broadcast antennas, has run into the situation where somebody was tempted to use a low power slug to measure reverse power. Let me go to Hal and Eric in that order. K6DPZ, have you run into this one? K2RIW in the TechNet?
W2OSR comment.
Okay, it's K6DPZ. OSR, did you want to make your comment before I make my dissertation?
That should be a short one, Hal. Thank you. Just did a little quick research on the internet. That square bore meter that you were talking about, believe it or not, is the Hewlett-Packard 415, which we know as a VSWR meter. The square bore part comes in when you use a crystal detector for power measurements.
Okay, so when it comes back to me after these other guys, we'll go back to that one. Yeah, that's a good point. I should have realized that one. So, Hal, have you seen people who made that silly measurement of using a 1 watt slug to try to measure very low return loss on a 1500 watt transmitter? K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Okay. Hey, Chuck Ned, this is K6DPZ. Well, I want to tell you a little way you could take low power elements and measure high power. This is an old trick. Let's say you want to have a kilowatt slug and you have a 250 watt slug. Okay, the trick to do is normally your slug will be reading 0 to on the 25 scale to 250 watt slug. Take and put a trip pot in series your 30 microamp meter and adjust your 250 watt slug so it's on another scale, not using the 25 scale, but use the 1000, the 100 scale, and bring it to 250. Once you do that, you will have that same element will work up to a kilowatt in both directions. You don't want to shunt the meter with your slug output. You want it to the resistance in series. And that way you're taking a 250 watt slug, making it into a kilowatt slug. You can do that on any bird slug with the frequency ranges you're working with. So that's my little comment. How to save money by one slug and get the use of May power ranges. Go ahead.
Terminating your system. How far away you are.
Yeah. I'm not in agreement with what you just heard. Hal has done it. He's gotten away with it. And if you're really sophisticated, you might get away with it. I don't recommend that as a general policy. And I think Eric, with a little more audio, Eric's going to tell us about his experience. Guaranteed, you've used through-line watt-meter-like devices, maybe the dynamic signal one, and you've measured 50-kilowatt-type transmitters with 50 kilowatt slugs, hopefully. So tell us your experience with through-line watt-meters and various slugs, and hopefully you've never taken a 1-watt slug to measure the reverse power of a 50-kilowatt transmitter. KE2EJ, KQRIW in the TechNet.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. Now, Hal's suggestion will work on older slugs, but I know the newer slugs, and I have them taken apart and made out of thin film resistors, and they don't tolerate much power. Don't forget, you're actually reading shunt across the terminating resistor, which is inside the slug. But anyway, I don't put things in that kind of punishment. The only thing that I actually do a direct reading with the third slug is actually the main power output, which is a 25-kilowatt slug, or 60-kilowatt, actually, no, 60-kilowatt slug on a big one. Most of the stuff that I do is because I have directional couplers in the feed line at various different places, and usually they're 30 to 50 feet down, and I use a very accurate, Agilent thermocouple type thermometer, so I don't run into making dumb things like that. Believe it or not, the power meter is quite accurate. It's got quite a lot of dynamic range, so, you know, I can be on a 60 dBm line and read accurately down to like minus 30 if I want to. It's KQRIW, KJ.
Fantastic. And as long as you know the true directivity of that directional coupler, those can be fun measurements. But run this by again. Did you tell me you've got a slug for a bird through-line watt meter, model 43, for instance? It can't be a model 43, which has a 50-kilowatt rating. And that can't be a bird model 43. That's a very different machine. You did say 50-kilowatt or 100-kilowatt.
I stick, and it's no different than a model 43, except it happens to be mounted on a piece of 8-inch line.
Fantastic. So you're telling me, if I understand correctly, that a particular slug made for your 8-inch diameter line, and it's made for that particular bird fixture that the power is flowing through, or bird...
makes the fixture...
A bird authorized fixture, that the slug itself is stamped on the front of the slug 50 or 100 kilowatts. Oh boy, I bet you hold that with tender loving care. You run that by again. KE2EJ, KQRIW, that sounds like fun.
Really hope we tighten those connectors good.
KQRIW, KE2EJ. The fixture that actually holds the slug is manufactured by Bird. It's a short segment of line, which has, you know, EIA flange, some ball fans. It comes in 8-inch, it comes in 3-inch, it comes in 1-inch and 7/8, and it also comes in 7/8. They make in different sizes. It's essentially a piece of pipe with a center conductor. It's like a piece of coax. With the little block that holds the slug in place with the stops on it and a little latch so you can pull the slug out. And it works exactly the same way the Model 43 does. Actually, on the pipes, they've got this little, what looks like an old RF connector that you've got on an ICO. And that actually hooks up to the meter.
I'm holding in my hand right now a bird slug, which says 1000E, 400 to 1000 megs, 1000 watts. I'm trying to picture what that slug would look like if it said across its face 50,000 watts. Or 100,000 watts.
I got a 25 kilowatt slug in my hand right now. It looks exactly the same as a 1-watt slug.
80-watt. Fantastic. That's a fun type machine. Mr. KBY? give us your full call and your name, sir. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, it's N1KBY. Jeff, the slugs look the same, but don't forget they have a different microamp rating. You're not going to get accurate measurements with a 43 in a through line section.
You're not going to put 60 kilowatts through a 43, it'll melt.
Yeah, the connect, no matter what the hell connector you got on the end, in other words, the right-hand side and the left-hand side, you could unscrew your type N, your type UHF, or whatever connector, and you could put, there's probably a 716 connector you could put there, but no matter what connector you put on the left and right side of a Bird 43, I'm having trouble believing you could get anything beyond 5 or so kilowatts. What do you think on that one, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
No, believe it or not, I don't know for 43 you can actually get 10 connectors on. The end connectors you put up to about 3 kilowatts. 10 connectors, you're starting to ask for trouble around, you know, a kilowatt and a half.
Yeah, one of the very good pieces of information I got as soon as I joined Airborne Instruments Laboratory way back in the dark ages of 1964, I ran into Hank Keene, W2CTK, who was, so to speak, the president or the general manager of the Rotary Joint Department, rotary joints for radar systems, and he's building these rotary joints that can tolerate 10 megawatts and 50 megawatts of power. And so he was telling me about an experiment that he did where he had a local polonium source and he found out that a type-N connector will tolerate 20 kilowatts of peak pulse power briefly without arcing over. But the center conductor, when you put CW power through it, anything beyond a kilowatt, even if you got brand new fresh gold plating and whatever, the current flowing through that center conductor will heat up and eventually becomes a failure mode. So beyond a kilowatt and a type-N, I know you're pushing your luck. So some people have gotten away with briefly doing 3 kilowatts on a very fresh, very good conditioned connector. Now, in your particular case, Eric, your 50 or 100 megawatt slug made for your particular piece of 8-inch diameter air line, a Bird manufactured component. Is there anything particular about that? Let me call it a 50 kilowatt slug. Is there anything particular about that kilowatt slug that would stop you from inserting it in a normal Bird Model 43, which can't take anywhere near that power? Is there a way that they have keyed it mechanically to stop you from putting the slug in the wrong test fixture? KE2EJ, K2LAW, in the TechNet. K2LAW, K2EJ,
well, the answer to that is no. It fits into exactly the same hole as a 43. It's exactly the same form factor. It's exactly the same. Although that other gentleman may be right in terms of the meters, the amount of microamps that the thing sticks out, I'm not certain of that, because it is my belief that the big meters that I have that are calibrated to 100 kilowatts, have the same connector that's actually inside the Bird 43. There's no difference between them as far as I can tell. Because I've used a big meter on a 43 and it's the same thing as the meter in the 43. So I don't know if that gentleman is correct or not. So I don't have an answer for that one.
They're 100 microamps. Okay, we'll eventually settle how many microamps is the actual meter movement and what are the real physical differences. But here's a question I've got for this learned group, and that is, we live in the United States in the 50 ohm universe. In other words, everything we care about, all of our instrumentation is 50 ohms. A good fraction of Europe lives in the 70 ohm world.
A good fraction of broadcasting lives at 72 ohms too, you know.
Particularly when it comes to your video cables. But are you telling me that even your RF transmission lines going to the antenna are 70 ohms? I'm having trouble believing that. But here's my question. Does Bird manufacture a Model 43-like device that's intended for 70 ohm transmission line service? Eric, KE2EJ, K2LAW.
60 TC with a comment.
Very fast comment, Dick. 10 seconds.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Eric first, go ahead, Eric.
Alright, if you remember a while back, we were discussing making the transition from 50 ohms to 72 ohms
with a piece of pipe,
where the diameter of the inside gets smaller and bigger. Actually, you can order from Bird, you can order the meter segment, the, what do they call it, the pickup device, the directional coupler, the thing that the slug fits into. You can order that either as a 72 ohm piece or as a 50 ohm piece. It just so happens that my main antenna at Plainview is 72 ohms, USA antenna. The dielectric antenna I have on the side is 50 ohms. And I actually have a transition to go from 50 ohms from the transmitter to 72 ohms in a piece of pipe. So yeah, you can get it any way you want.
6DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, before I go over to Hal, let me finish with Eric first. Eric, the machine that's made the Bird 43-like main fixture, where you can buy it for 70 ohms, do the exact same slugs give the exact same power indication on the 70 ohm meter, or are the slugs in some way different? KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Okay, good question.
Now, I don't know if they make a 43 size meter, which is, you know, coaxial, little end connectors, but in the broadcast world. Actually, there's three, but it makes three different types of slugs. There's a type A, a type B, and a type C. One reads peak power for broadcast, and they have another type that actually reads average peak power for digital stuff, which actually has a meter which has a, I think it's got a logarithmic amplifier, and I'm not sure exactly what it is. And you have the standard type A slugs, which you're used to seeing. So when you order a device for 72 ohms, you do get a matching. You get a slug that looks exactly the same, but it's calibrated for that particular fixture.
What stops you from putting the right slug in the wrong fixture, like a 50 ohm slug in a 70 ohm fixture? If you did that, what would happen, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, I think the first thing that would happen if you called up Bird is they would nicely tell you you're a moron. You're not supposed to do that. But you're going to get a slight difference in reading. There's actually a conversion curve in the literature for the broadcast stuff. I don't know about the two-way stuff. No, in the small meter, there's 43, but for the broadcast gear, you get actually, with each slug, you get a calibration chart.
Interesting. Now, Hal, you've seen lots of Bird 43s in your life. I bet you've seen 5,000 of them. I bet you're a very small percentage of them in the United States are 70-ohm machines. But we're slowly finding out they do exist. And it looks like there are different slugs for the 50 and the 70. Tell us how many errors have occurred along these lines, and how often have you seen a 70-ohm Bird-like machine? K6DBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW in the TechNet, K6DBZ. Okay, first off, the Bird 43 watt meter uses a 30 microamp meter. Not 100 microamp, not 200 microamp, not a 1 milliamp. 30 microamp. That's why, being it's a delicate meter, when you put the slug half mast, it shorts out the meter so it won't get damaged. As far as 70 ohm Bird, I really haven't come across them, to be honest with you. When we run forward power at 70 ohms or 72 ohms, I use a U-attacker line section and stick an RF probe from a 410 C in. E squared divided by R gives me the power. If I'm not looking just for the power, if I'm not looking for a reflected power. So a 70 ohm, I haven't really seen it. They're there, I'm sure. And a larger of line samplers for, you know, like 3 to 4 inch line and bigger, as with Eric mentioned, they do use the same basic Bird slug. They're still coupling off the center section, but with a directional characteristic. To RIW, this is K6 Delta Papa Zulu.
Now, there is a section of the Bird owner's manual that describes a particular situation that occurs. They told you that if you had a well-matched 70-ohm transmission line and you put your 50-ohm Bird into that 70 ohm line. You will measure an apparent 1.4 standing wave ratio, 70 divided by